welcome to today's program titled Protecting Trade Secrets in the Social Media Age. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you're encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. For those who are interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to our speakers. You may begin.
Good morning or afternoon, depending on from where you're joining us today. We're thrilled to have you joining us for the fifth installment of Seyfarth Shaw's ongoing trade secret webinar series. This month, we're covering the topic of protecting trade secrets in the social media age. My name is Justin Beyer, and along with Dawn Mertonite and Ryan Bendelman, we will be presenting a variety of topics today, focusing in on what is a trade secret, an introduction to social media concerns and why we should care. We're going to then cover some relevant case law dealing with topics that are hot in the social media and trade secret spectrum. We're then going to transition into talking about what the social media legislation landscape currently looks like. And finally, we're going to cover some best practices for how you and your companies or you and your clients should be handling social media procedures and policies and effectively trying to protect or best protect trade secrets in this newly or not so newly anymore emerging area of the media and the internet. So what is a trade secret? A trade secret has been defined, not very helpfully, as one of the most elusive and difficult concepts in the law. Breaking that down a little bit more, 48 out of the 50 states have defined a trade secret through the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And effectively, this defines what constitutes a trade secret and what it means when a misappropriation has occurred of a trade secret. For anyone outside of Massachusetts or New York, you would be following the Uniform Trade Secret Act, but for those of you in Massachusetts or New York, the common law in those states is pretty similar to the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. So what exactly is a trade secret? Well, a trade secret is defined as information that's generally not known to others, that has economic value to a company, that is subject to reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy. And that could be anything. There's nothing that requires specific novelty in defining a trade secret. So, you know, trade secret could be a chemical process that a company has decided not to subject to patent protections. It could be manufacturing methods. It could be business and marketing plans, customer lists, negative know-how, such as failed research attempts. But for purposes of today, we're really going to be focusing in on the concept of trade secrets in more of a customer list type standpoint and how that's applicable when you're talking about social media. Generally speaking, why it matters, any business that's dealing with trade secrets has employees. And therein lies where the primary people who take trade secrets reside. They generally are former employees or business partners. Generally speaking, it happens by electronic means. Why this happens? Well, they have access to the information. The newly emerging tools of technology makes stealing that such information much easier than it was in the past. This isn't an age in which one has to come in on the weekends and copy things or print things off from a computer. But at this point in time, you can do it through a variety of means. Recently, though, the United States Congress, or about a year and a half ago, instituted the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which is intended to make prosecuting these types of claims easier. And effectively, the Defend Trade Secrets Act, also known as DTSA, effectively defines a trade secret in much the same ways that the Uniform Trade Secret Act does, but allows companies or individuals to file the lawsuit with original jurisdiction in a federal district court. There are a couple nuances of which you should be aware. There needs to be specific language in a non-compete agreement that's entered into after May 11, 2016, which identifies for an employee that there are certain immunity and anti-retaliation provisions. Specifically, if you fail to do so, you will not be entitled to recover double damages or attorney's fees. So that's clearly something you'd want to insert into your agreements. There's also various things that aren't trade secrets. You know, we're going to talk today, and we're really just going to scratch the surface, but really things that are found publicly, generally speaking, aren't trade secrets. There are instances in which compilations of information can be combined in such a way as to create trade secret protection. We're not really going to be focusing so much on that today, but you could arguably make the case that when you combine a host of LinkedIn followers or Twitter followers or Facebook followers, possibly that might constitute publicly available information that is combined to create a trade secret. And Don will talk about that a little bit later on in what is actually a trade secret in the case law review. The other thing that needs to happen, and we briefly mentioned it in talking about what it is to be a trade secret, is that companies need to take specific steps to ensure that the trade secret remains a secret. Once the information is disclosed publicly, it's very hard to make the argument that it's not a trade secret. Now, there are caveats to that, one of which being that if the trade secret is disclosed by a disgruntled employee and the company takes immediate steps to attempt to get the information back into the box, so to speak, then courts have said it can maintain its trade secret protection. But let's say it gets printed on your website, your customers who you do business with, your suppliers, very difficult to convince a court that the identities of those companies or suppliers constitute a trade secret. The level of secrecy that's required, you don't need to lock these things away in a secure vault in Fort Knox. You just need to take reasonable steps. And what that really means is going to depend on a company-by-company basis. But generally speaking, password protections, confidentiality, non-disclosure agreements with your employees, with business partners or third parties to whom the information is being made available, key card, badges, things along those lines are going to be the types of things that courts are going to look at to see whether or not the information has been treated as confidential. So why do we care? Why do we care about this information in the context of social media? Well, in 2013, Semantics and Poneman performed a study, and they looked at the internet and email usage of thousands of employees over a host of developed countries. And what they found is that over half of those employees are on a very, very regular basis emailing work documents, sensitive materials to a personal email account. That a large percentage of them are downloading information to their smartphones or tablets. And that a very large percent, 37%, use file sharing applications such as Dropbox or Google Docs without company permission. Now, this is a study that was about 4.5 years ago. So at this point in time, those numbers are no doubt higher than what they looked like in 2013. And why this creates a real concern is that when you couple this information with the fact and the visibility of social media, the ability for information to be shared in an improper means or taken by an employee through one of these various websites creates real concern for employers or businesses out there. We're going to talk a lot today about how the followers and the users can constitute trade secrets in this realm. But there's a secondary issue there, which is the ability to quickly disseminate this type of information across a large platform of people and how you can arguably get that back in the box. So while we're going to focus on what is a trade secret in the realm of social media, it's also worth considering and thinking about when we start talking a little bit later on about the policies, about what a company wants to do in order to either block access to these websites or really monitoring their employees' use, and when they exit your company, really being mindful of ensuring that there's no information walking out the door as well. And here's just a few of the additional social media sites that are out there. So the question is what do we need to do in order to protect trade secrets in the digital age? And it's a complicated question, and it's even more complicated solution. Truly, the one-word response is probably vigilance. You need to be vigilant as a company to ensure that you have policies in place, that you have offboarding procedures in place so that you're really taking care to ensure that you're receiving all the information, that employees don't have your confidential information on cloud sharing or cloud storage websites or on external media devices or in their personal email account. And frankly, waiting until after they're gone to start asking those questions is really too late. So you need to be thinking about this really from the outset of employment, reminding people of the secrecy of the information, and then taking specific steps when you're offboarding them. And without further ado, I'm going to turn things over to Dawn, and Dawn is going to talk about some relevant case law dealing with social media.
Thanks, Justin. As he mentioned, I'm going to talk a little bit about what the courts have said in recent years about some of these hot topics in social media. And frankly, there haven't been that many cases in the last couple of years, but as you will see, there are some cases that are still coming out. So this is certainly still a new topic, and it's still being litigated. It's not something that was the issues were not determined years ago. So we're going to look at some of those cases, old and new. So first, whether customer lists are considered trade secrets in social media or ownership issues. Those are some of the big things. So I'm going to start here with Sasqua Group versus Courtney. It's a case that came out of the Eastern District of New York. I think it was in about 2010. In that case, the company sued a former employee for stealing confidential customer lists after she started her own consulting business. Unfortunately for the company, the employee who had departed was able to successfully argue that the lists weren't confidential because all of the information could be found online. And in fact, it was actually a very compelling argument on her behalf because at the PI hearing, she was able to show on the stand to the judge that Sasqua Group was connected to all of its customers through its LinkedIn account, and she was able to access all those names just by logging in. So that was very compelling to the court, and the court consequently ruled in her favor and essentially decided that if a company links to a customer on LinkedIn in such a way that other LinkedIn users can see that information, that is not considered a trade secret because just as Justin said earlier, you need to have some level of secrecy, and if it's something that anyone can look at just by logging into LinkedIn, that's not going to be considered a trade secret. Next, the Phone Dog versus Kravitz case. This is a high-profile case that came out of the Northern District of California in which one of the company's employees had managed the company's Twitter account. When he left, he changed the Twitter handle from, I think it was Phone Dog Kravitz to @NoahKravitz, and the company sued him, stating that the Twitter account belonged to the company and, you know, all the Twitter followers, those were the company's property. The employee moved to dismiss the case, and the court denied the motion to dismiss. So this ended up in further litigation, the parties ended up settling, and the employee ended up getting control of the Twitter account. He still has it to this day. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later when we're talking about what you can do to make sure that you're protecting your company. In this case, it was difficult because there was no clear agreement between the company and the employee. And then finally, Christou versus Beatport. It's a 2012 case. A club owner had sued his former partner, claiming that the partner had misappropriated the company's MySpace login and password. Now, the MySpace seems to sort of be a thing of the past, but again, this is only 5 years ago. And the club owner alleged that the former partner had stolen the MySpace friends list. The court ultimately determined that a friend relationship on MySpace could be considered a secret and denied the former partner's motion to dismiss. So again, this just shows that these cases aren't easily resolved in most cases unless there's some agreement as to who owns what on social media. On the next slide here, you'll see CDM Media versus Sims. It's an Illinois case from 2015. CDM had sued its former employee for, among other things, refusing to transfer control of an allegedly private LinkedIn group that it claimed it owned. And the court determined that whether the membership list in the private LinkedIn account was a trade secret was a question of fact and denied, in part, the defendant's motion to dismiss the employer's misappropriation claim. Again, just showing that these things aren't easily resolved up front. Cellular Accessories for Less versus Trinitas, that's a California case from 2014. The court determined that remaining connected on LinkedIn with a former employer's customers could be a misappropriation of trade secrets, but the court denied summary judgment because there were disputed facts regarding whether all LinkedIn users could see those connections or whether it really was more private. So again, in that case, we're not even talking about a motion to dismiss, we're talking about summary judgment. So these cases are getting deep into discovery and even beyond. One case that is really interesting to look at is this Veronica Foods versus Eklund case. And the reason I find this interesting is because it's very recent. As you can see, June 29th, 2017, it was published. So again, these are not issues that have been resolved and everyone knows how to handle them. This is something that's coming up on a day-to-day basis. In this case, the plaintiff brought an action for misappropriation under the Defend Trade Secret Act, which Justin just talked about a few minutes ago, and the California Uniform Trade Secret Act. And the company claimed that the former employee had misappropriated its customer and supplier list. Now, the former employee moved to dismiss the case, arguing in part that the customer and supplier list couldn't be a trade secret because if you looked at the plaintiff's Facebook page, they publicized lots of their customers. And that was, in fact, compelling to the court and convinced the court to grant the motion to dismiss. And in so doing, the court said, the mere fact that those retailers were Veronica Foods customers might itself be a trade secret. But Veronica Foods does not sufficiently allege that. Instead, the material defendants have submitted for judicial notice demonstrates that Veronica Foods itself had publicized its relationship with many of its customers. So again, even in 2017, we're seeing companies still publicizing things that they later are claiming are trade secrets. So you need to be very careful if you're arguing that you have a trade secret, you need to be taking reasonable measures. And it's understandable that companies would want to publicize their customer relationships, but if you consider those relationships secret, you have to be very careful about that. Some more ownership issues. We talked earlier about the PhoneDog versus Kravitz case, but just to reiterate, where there was no agreement between the company and the employee as to who owned the Twitter account, it became very difficult for the court to determine at an early stage who would own that account. And again, ultimately, the employee retained possession of the Twitter account. In Eagle versus Morgan, the employee had been encouraged by the employer, who was a bank, to create a LinkedIn account, but there were no clear policies as to who owned that LinkedIn account. The employee left the bank, and the bank ended up changing her password and login and replaced her name and photo on LinkedIn with her replacement's name and photo. The court ultimately determined that the plaintiff had proven misappropriation, and that while the company had encouraged the creation of linked accounts, the fact that there were no policies regarding ownership indicated that they did not have an ownership interest. So again, the moral of the story, if you want to retain ownership of social media accounts, then you need to put that in writing. It should be part of the employee's employment agreement. Some more ownership issues. I'm going to start with the second one here, CDM Media versus Sims. Again, we talked about that one previously, and as I just noted a few minutes ago, ownership of a LinkedIn group was not incorporated into the employment agreement, and as a result, the court denied the defendant's motion to dismiss. Artis Health is notable because that is actually a case where there was an agreement that discussed the ownership of the social media account. In that case, the employee, Nankivell, was a video and social media producer, and she had created a social media website in 2010 with another employee as part of their work for the company. The employer eventually fired her, and after doing so, requested access to the social media website. She refused to provide access. Again, as I just mentioned, unlike in other cases, there was an agreement that that website belonged to the employer and not the employee. So the court determined that the employer owned the account and the account's content due to the agreement and ordered the return of the account. One of the other really big issues in social media and trade secrets and non-competes in general is what constitutes solicitation on social media. Now, each platform has different ways of connecting with people, but again, the whole point of social media is to be social. So on LinkedIn, you connect with other members. Facebook, you become friends with someone. On Twitter, you can either tweet at them or you can follow them or have them follow you. And a lot of cases early in the age of social media address this and consider what is truly solicitation on social media. And as you will see, you actually need to show more than just a simple connection. So Enhanced Network Solutions Group versus Hypersonic, that's a case from Indiana, 2011, fairly early. The court determined that a public LinkedIn job posting that was not targeted to a former employer's customers did not constitute solicitation. Similarly, Prepaid Legal Services versus Cahill out of Oklahoma in 2013, the court determined that Twitter invites and Facebook posts about an individual's new employer did not violate a non-solicit agreement. And more recently in 2017, out of Illinois, Bankers Life and Casualty Company, the court determined that sending LinkedIn invitations to former colleagues didn't violate a non-solicit agreement. So these show that you need to have a little bit more to prove solicitation. And likewise, BTS USA versus Executive Perspectives, LinkedIn posts were deemed not to be solicitation. The court determined that there was no evidence that the former employer's customers had actually received the LinkedIn post from the former employee, had viewed the new employer's website, or conducted any business with the new employer as a result of these LinkedIn invitations. And finally, NVIDIA versus DeFonso, the court determined in Massachusetts in 2012 that an employee did not violate their non-compete simply by becoming Facebook friends with former clients and posting about their new jobs. So to the extent you see that one of your former employees is connecting with other people on a variety of LinkedIn platforms, that might be very concerning to you as the employer. But what these cases show is that you need a little bit more than just that. You're probably going to spend some money and time, and if you don't have more than just them connecting with people on a variety of these platforms, you probably will not be able to show a violation of a non-solicit. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ryan. Although before Ryan takes over, I'm going to read the CLE code. The code is SS, as in Seyfarth Shaw, 1252. Again, that's SS1252. And Ryan, take it away.
Thanks, Dawn. So we've talked a lot so far about trade secrets and all of the issues that can arise because of social media in employment situations. So it would make total sense for people to be able to, for employers to be able to access social media accounts, personal accounts of their employees to make sure that their trade secrets are being protected. But unfortunately, that is not the case. And more states have been enacting legislation that protect employees' accounts. And as you can see here, a majority of states now have legislation in place that protect employees' information and govern employers' legal obligations as it relates to what they can and cannot do in regard to employees' personal social media accounts. And just this past year, we have D.C., Nebraska, Vermont, and West Virginia who have joined the ranks, thus giving a majority of states now that have such legislation in place. So what do these laws typically look like? Well, most all of these laws have pretty much the same prohibitions in place. Mainly, you can't ask an employee or an applicant typically for their username and password to their social media accounts. You can't ask them to add your company as a contact on there either. And you think you can get around that by having them access it and then looking over their shoulder. Well, that's not allowed either. And something that I've heard as well folks have attempted to do, which you can't do, is create fake profiles to try to access the personal accounts of employees or applicants. All of those are pretty much no-nos in all of these 27 states. And every year, there are more and more states adding to this list. So this is becoming more of the norm than just, you know, a one-off situation. Another thing you can't do is you can't retaliate against an employee or an applicant for refusing to provide access if you ask for it. You also can't retaliate against an employee who serves as a witness for ongoing litigation in terms of if somebody had brought a suit because of this. So those are pretty much the same across those 27 states with little variation. What does vary, though, are the consequences for violations of this law or these laws. And they really do vary. They vary from heavy. States like Oregon, you can be subject to lawsuits, penalties, attorney's fees, a whole host of things. Some states are lighter, like New Jersey. They may investigate. They may impose nominal fees or penalties. They may be complaints to the Department of Labor. And then there's California. California, the fines can be up to $1,000 for the first violation and up to $5,000 for subsequent violations, plus complaints to the Department of Labor. So it can get pretty serious. So these are laws that we do not want to violate because it could have dire results. So what can you do? Well, there definitely are some things that you're still permitted to do under these laws. First, one of them has to do with non-personal accounts. So employer accounts, accounts opened at the employer's request that are used for business purposes. There's really no problem with a company accessing an account that it owns. And again, we'll talk about later about ways to craft policies that make it clear who owns these accounts. There are also some other ways that an employer could gain access. One is to investigate suspected workplace misconduct investigations related to misappropriation or data theft. If there's a harassment situation that's ongoing, and we'll talk more about that later as well, that may be a situation where the company can gain access or information from a personal account. But of course, before a company goes and tries to gain that access, it's always important to consult your attorney first to find out how to do that properly. Now, also, if an employer provides a device, they can monitor that device. And it just needs to be made clear in the employer employment handbook or employer agreement that there is going to be a device that will be monitored as well. And also, publicly available information is always okay. So if you have an applicant or an employee and you want to do a Google search about them to see what comes up for the whole world to see, you're more than welcome to do that. There's no law that I've seen that prohibits publicly shared information or publicly available information from being accessed by an employer. Now also, social media impacts labor laws as well. It's gotten the attention of the National Labor Relations Board, and it does impact and is impacted by the National Labor Relations Act. In particular, an employee is protected under Section 7 of the NLRA when they're engaging in discussions about work conditions with other coworkers on social media. And this could take many different forms. This could be information shared about wage issues or complaining about policies or managers, wanting to drum up union support. There could be posts on Facebook about that. Now, just making posts themselves, while that's protected, there are other things that are protected too. If an employee simply likes a post about one of these issues, that's protected as well, and you can't retaliate against them or take action because of that either. Now, here are some examples as well from some cases. Pretty much some of the same things I just spoke about. Online activities that are protected, social media posts about terms and conditions of employment, and liking a discussion about work conditions. But for these to be protected, it must be concerted protected activity and not just personal gripes. So it has to affect policies that impact more than just that one individual employee. So what's not protected are individual gripes. So for example, if a post was made on Facebook saying, "I don't like my boss, he's a fill in your favorite expletive," that's probably not going to be protected because that sounds more like a personal gripe than something that affects the work conditions in a more concerted sense. Now also, just so you know, we have recently updated our desktop reference guide, which details all of the social media legislation in all of the states that I spoke of in the last slide that you saw before. And the guide has great information also on how to navigate the various issues that social media presents in the workplace. And with that, that's a good transition into our next section to talk about some best practices on how to craft policies and agreements that not only protect the company legally, but also work within your own individual workspace. And in this section, I'm going to talk a little more broadly, not just about trade secrets, but other implications of social media in the workplace. So clearly, there are risks when it comes to social media in the workplace, not just with trade secrets, but some other risks as well. For instance, harassment. For example, say a male employee on his own personal Facebook page made some lewd comments about a female coworker. That's an issue that could affect the workplace. We've spoken about the disclosure of companies' confidential, proprietary, and/or trade secret information. And to the extent that that is breached, the harm can grow from that exponentially. All competitors or parties on the outside can learn of that information, and it's hard, if not impossible, to rein that information back in once it's out there. Now, another thing that's very difficult to rein back in once it's out there is embarrassment to the company. Now, many of you may have already heard of or be aware of the situation that happened in 2009 with Domino's Pizza. Funny note, just 2 days ago, actually, I was on Facebook and I saw an article about 10 ways that employees got terminated because of social media. And the Domino's incident was on that list. 8 years later, it's still out there popping up on my Facebook page. So what happened with Domino's, for those of you who don't know? Not to gross anybody out, but it might just a little bit, but what happened in 2009 was there were two Domino's pizza workers while at work. They decided or thought it would be funny to post a video on YouTube and on some other sites where they were preparing sandwiches and doing questionable things with the food. As you can see, a picture here is of the employee putting a piece of cheese up his nose before putting it on a sandwich. And there were some other really gross things that also happened, which I'm not going to go into, but feel free to look it up yourself. But while these employees, they said it was a prank, they said that none of this food actually went out to anybody, they were just doing it to be funny. But due to the power of social media and how far this could reach, more than a million people saw this video. People who, you know, constantly are eating Domino's pizza. I still eat Domino's pizza to this day. But it created a public relations crisis. And there were even felony charges with these employees involved. It was a big mess for the company. And so that embarrassment, you can't rein that back in. I'll bet this video and this situation will be talked about for years to come. So, how do we ward off against this sort of situation? We want to craft policies that make things very clear to the employee. Now, while you cannot dictate everything, and you cannot be sure that your employees are going to follow policies as they should. I'm sure those Domino's employees breached some policies as well that may not have been explicitly laid out, but I'm sure they breached some policies that were on the books, and they still did it. But we can craft policies that will make sure that employees know what they can and cannot do. And as we spoke about before, who owns the social media accounts and how it impacts the company. So the first thing into crafting a good social media policy is addressing proper use, acknowledging that the company may provide employees with internet access, that it is a useful business tool, and that employees must use it properly. A social media policy should also address that social media should not be used during work hours while using company-provided equipment or systems. But it also is important, and we talked about labor laws before, we also want to craft a policy that makes it clear that the company is only seeking to regulate social media activity that impacts the company, so that it doesn't run afoul of the NLRA. Now also, a social media policy should make clear that there is no expectation of privacy in social media activities done at work, on work time, or using company equipment or systems, and that employees must always be following the company's conduct standards and its policies, that they should not be defaming anyone or damaging the reputation of anyone or the company. Nothing should be disclosed on social media. Now, the next thing that also should be made clear, as we said before, in these policies is ownership. So who owns the social media account? Well, obviously, if it's an employee's personal account, they own those accounts. But if the company wants to provide a job-specific account, whether it's employer-provided or employer-required, the contract between the company and the employee should identify that employer-mandated or run accounts are the property of the employer, and that includes all followers and all business that has been developed through that account. And there should also be specific wording saying that upon termination, the employee must turn over the login and password to that company-owned account. And then also that those company-owned accounts should be used for authorized purposes only. And the job description or agreement or policy should define those purposes. Now here's just some other best practices here. Prohibiting the use of company email addresses for use with personal social media accounts. Informing employees that failure to abide by these guidelines or standards can result in discipline up to termination and potentially legal action. Again, back to the Domino's situation, there was legal action involved after that situation went public. And these social media policies should be integrated into existing policies, whether it's the IT policy, electronic systems and use, confidentiality, code of conduct, and harassment policy. And again, the agreement must address ownership and return of any property that has been given to the employee. And that includes employer-provided devices, but also those accounts that the employer either provided or required to be open. And also in these agreements, it may be wise to consider some state law concerns. Primarily, some states' laws have an actual definition of what is a personal account. And it may be wise to craft a policy or an agreement that specifies a choice of law provision that would apply to the agreement where there is a more defined definition of personal account. Now, a couple other considerations when crafting these policies. You might want to consider blocking problematic internet websites, such as file sharing and internet mail sites. And some examples of these we spoke about previously, but Google Docs or Google Drive, Dropbox is another very popular one as well. That can absolutely assist in making sure that sensitive materials, confidential information, trade secrets are not being easily shared from the company's equipment. And it's also very important to provide recurring training on the company's social media and confidentiality policies. Particularly, it's important to make sure that all HR professionals and supervisors are trained in the policies and in the laws that are applicable to their state. And it's also recommended that a policy recommends that supervisors not engage in social media with subordinates. Now, I say recommend and not completely prohibit because there are some state laws, for example, California, where certain off-duty conduct is protected. So, for instance, by banning a supervisor from communicating with a subordinate outside of work, that's not illegal. So California wouldn't want you to make that a mandatory thing, but it can be recommended. It's always a good recommendation. So when regulating, monitoring, and enforcing these policies, it's important to be consistent because you do not want to open yourself up to a risk of a claim of discrimination. For example, you don't want somebody claiming that you're only monitoring men or only terminating older employees who violate the social media policy. So you want to be consistent and you want to treat like situations the same. Now you also want to consider invasion of privacy issues as well. Now what you want to think about here is, does the employee have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the social media account? So if it's an employer-provided account, or if the employer required the employee to open the account, likely there would not be any expectation of privacy that a court would find in that account. But if it's a personal account that the employee had prior to working and or even opened after starting employment but maintains on their own, that was never asked for, that was never addressed in an agreement, then they probably would have an expectation of privacy there. So you also want to think about, if you obtain information, how was that information obtained? Was there a secure website that you had to go to get that information? Did the employer have access or permission to be on that website? Did it involve a situation where the employee friended the employer on Facebook? Or, like I mentioned before, did the employer create a fake friend to access information? Those are all things that are taken into consideration when considering invasion of privacy issues and disputes. And as I mentioned just on the last slide, there is some off-duty lawful conduct, some recreational activities that may be protected under your state's laws. The most common is tobacco and alcohol use. Now, it's legal, if it's legal, for tobacco and alcohol to be consumed, and it is for pretty much everybody of a certain age in every state, then if there's a Facebook post where an employee is out having drinks with friends, even if the company may not like the consumption of alcohol or like what they see, your state laws may protect that, and there may not be any action that you can take against the employee. So again, it's important to consult your HR professionals, consult your attorneys, before taking any kind of action. Also, in some states, political activity may be protected. For instance, California and New York are very similar. They prohibit an employer from interfering with an employee's political activities. And that could include posts made on social media regarding political things. Now, it's also important to think about former employees as well, because you can craft certain things in agreements if there's a separation agreement with former employees, and you also want to think about giving recommendations and references after the fact to employees. So one of the biggest things that I've seen these days are recommendations on LinkedIn. Because you can go on LinkedIn, you can say good things about somebody, you know, they did a great job for me on XYZ job. This could cause some problems, and I want you to think about it as well. We don't recommend giving those recommendations on LinkedIn because if a recommended employee, say, is later terminated, the employee may try to use that recommendation as evidence of pretext in a later discrimination suit or some other kind of suit as well. So a best practice here is to consider routing these requests to a central source so that things can be clearly documented. You can clearly document who is requesting information, for what purpose they're requesting it, what information exactly was provided. Or you could also have a policy regarding not providing references and just make sure that employees know that there is such a policy in place, that references are not allowed to be given, and make sure they know the reason why, that it's not anything negative against them, it's just an across-the-board policy to protect the company and the situation. Now, you can also craft separation agreements that modify these agreements to address social media. And these are being done more and more often, and it's great. You want to add in things like non-disparagement clauses. Non-disparagement clauses that specifically say, the employee agrees not to disparage the company on social media or any other online source. Things like that. And that protects the company as well from a disgruntled employee saying negative things later on after they leave the company. So that brings us to the end. We do want to thank everybody for showing up today and listening to our presentation. And we do encourage everybody to come visit our blog. It's tradesecretslaw.com. We have articles constantly going on there about any new developments in trade secrets law. And lastly, we have our contact information there too in case you have any questions for us that may not have been addressed today. We do have about 6 or 7 minutes left, so we will open it up for some questions now, but if we don't get to your question, please feel free to email or call us, and we would love to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. To ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question. Once again, to ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question.
There are a couple questions about the CLE code for those of you who missed it in the middle of the presentation. That is SS1252. Again, SS1252. Seeing no other questions, I think we can close down the chat but a couple minutes early, but thank you so much. Oh, we do have a question. We have a question from David asking, have you seen any significant problems with LinkedIn recommendations provided after separation? And Don, maybe we can have you look at the, or ask to answer that question from the case law standpoint of what you saw.
Yeah, I haven't come across any cases that address this, so I'm not sure if it's something that just isn't frequently litigated, but it hasn't been something that's been at the forefront of the case law. So I'm not sure that courts have really considered this. I don't know if, Ryan, you have any recommendations just based on best practices.
Just based on best practices, I would just be careful. I mean, I haven't seen anything myself personally. I know that, just through hearsay, it has happened and it has been a consideration. I think it's just something to be careful of is really what it comes down to.
We also have another question from Kim asking if we can explain a little bit more about how to integrate the social media policy with other policies, and I'm happy to field this one. I think from a best practice standpoint, a place in which this can be embedded is probably in the code of conduct. Most companies with which we work have in some cases, fairly lengthy codes of conduct. And it seems to me that if you insert maybe an additional page that talks about what the social media policy is, since generally speaking, lots of companies with whom we work will circulate new codes of conduct or a refresher signature page for the code of conduct on an annual or semi-annual basis, this is a good way for you to update anything you see from a code of conduct standpoint. The other place you could potentially do it, if you have an IT policy that's disseminated to your employees, that might be another place that you could integrate a social media policy. Really the key though, and I think this is an important takeaway, is with any sort of policy that you do have, it really is truly very important to have some sort of process where you're explaining the expectations of the company to employees. And obviously, you know, we can all agree that we probably have a few too many meetings already in our weekly and monthly schedules. But even if you're having something on a somewhat monthly basis, on a semi-yearly basis or on a yearly basis, this would be an important topic to add to, you know, to that sort of presentation.
Yeah, just to piggyback on that, Justin, to reiterate, the cases that we see in this field often turn on whether there's anything in writing that address these issues. And it's much easier to come to a swift resolution or even avoid litigation entirely if you have something in a policy. If you don't have it and it's a little bit murky, which is understandable because this is still a relatively new area, then you're possibly tied up in litigation beyond even a motion to dismiss or summary judgment. So regularly updating policies to take into consideration the new technologies is really important and is well worth your time.
We have a couple more questions, a couple follow-up questions. One is asking the question about Glassdoor. Ryan or Dawn, have either of you seen any issues arising from Glassdoor? I believe it's a website where you can do some job placements and things like that.
I haven't seen anything, but I do think that that's going to be an area that we will start to see some litigation and some new trends, because my understanding of Glassdoor is that a lot of it is anonymous, and so you might have some disparagement issues. And so I think we're going to see that crop up more and more. I haven't seen it yet really hit the forefront of the case law, but that's something I certainly could look into to see if that's come up, and I will do that. I'm going to write myself a note.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything yet, but it's definitely something that, since that's popped up, I've been wondering about as well when we were going to start seeing things. So, yeah, I'll be on the lookout for that also.
Well, it looks like we have a couple more, but we are at our hour. We will try to follow up with some of the subsequent questions that came in. Thanks everyone for attending today. We hope you'll join us in our subsequent months for future trade secret webinars. And thanks everyone again.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.